the last frontier becomes less of a frontier, we begin to realize it's time to coexist with nature rather than try to tame or exploit it. But any Alaskan would tell you a predator is still a predator. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we'll be looking at research that's gone along with the reintroduction and expansion of predator range in the lower 48. Call statewide toll-free 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, local call in Anchorage, 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. What can and can't be done to further a coexisting with predators, the subject on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, this is one of the subjects that Alaskans have no end of things to say about, and that is predators. There's a new book out from Beacon Press. Beacon Press, it's called The Predator Paradox, Ending the War with Wolves, Bears, Cougars, and Coyotes by John A. Shivick. John is the Mammal Program Coordinator of the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources and teaches at Brigham Young and Utah State. And he joins us by cell phone connection from Logan, Utah. John, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So are you up in coyote country? Of course you're in coyote country.
What's not coyote country?
Yeah. You know, in, where I grew up in Pennsylvania, I never saw a black growing up. Coyotes were utterly unheard of. And now they got coyotes in the in Allegheny Plateau in Pennsylvania and tons of black bears. I can't believe it. I mean, it's not that they didn't have them before. There were hardly any of them around. And the coyotes are all over the eastern United States. And I guess they're probably the biggest problem when it comes to predators in the lower 48 now, aren't they?
Yeah, just by sheer numbers. Coyotes are out there. They're in cities. They're among people. They're definitely responsible for the most, you know, damage and attacks and all those sorts of things. There's just so many of them, and they do so well in and around people. Bears are probably going to be getting to be a number two here, you know, pretty soon as they're expanding. But yeah, no, that's a great point. We're in a different world than we were 30 years ago in terms of our predator populations. And my whole thoughts on this is, well, what are we going to do about it? We're sort of at a crossroads here. We got to decide which way we're going to go.
Yeah, and it's a very striking cover you have on your book. You have the coyote, and then you have a string with a bunch of red flags on it, and then you have some sheep. And then you have another string. And then you have, maybe it's a wolf, this one here.
Yeah, they're wolves, yeah.
And they're not going across this string with the flags hanging off of it. You're telling me something like that actually works?
Yeah, it does. So it's called fladry, and it's pretty interesting in that it was first, worked with or developed or whatever, back in Eastern Europe hundreds of years ago, where the people would just string this up through the forest. So they'd have ropes with flags and clothing and things like that hanging off of it. And they'd make a big funnel in the forest, essentially. And then people would make noises and whatever, and sort of wrestle the animals and scare them, and everything would run. And, of course, anything like deer or whatever is going to jump over this is just, you know, some flags hanging on a rope 3 feet high. But wolves, for whatever reason, are really wary of this. They're kind of naturally wary of most things human anyway. But they would see this, and they wouldn't want to jump over it or go under it or whatever. So they could actually use this to corral animals and put them into a smaller area. They just kind of funnel them into a small area where people would sit at the end with their clubs or guns or whatever and kill the wolves. So it's sort of a sport hunting of kings. And then some later researchers realized that they could use the same technique to capture wolves, to put radio collars and things on them. So they did the same thing. They strung fladry through the forest. They corralled the wolves. They got them into a small area. They captured them, put collars on them. And then since then, there's been a fair amount of research, or a few papers anyway, where we'd use this stuff to surround corrals, and wolves were reluctant to go through it, and coyotes to some extent. Some limitations. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, things will definitely habituate. I mean, any one thing like this is only going to work for a certain amount of time, but if you have a narrow window when you've got to keep these things away, it's a viable technique. It's pretty neat.
We're talking with John Shivick. He's author of the book, The Predator Paradox. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. And I don't want to dwell too much on these flags because, it's a fascinating thing. But as you point out, there's going to be habituation, and they're not going to work for a long, extended period of time. But essentially, your book uses this as just one of many, many efforts that you document in here in terms of trying to establish a working relationship with real ranging predators and real livestock raisers and real recreational users and so forth. And your fundamental point then comes to be that things might be very polarized right now. We know they're very polarized, but people really need to learn how to talk to one another and start looking in the direction of solutions. And I suppose even beyond that, you would suggest that many of the solutions might be just temporary, but nonetheless be effective, and that science is going to do nothing but help this. And science is the very thing where it's very hard to get money to do this research. And you point to this, you point this out towards the end of the book. You get just a little emotional because mostly you take a sort of a distanced approach, which is good, I think, because you're talking to a polarized audience. But towards the end, you start saying, well, if all the money that was given to environmental groups and animal lover groups, some of which is paid back as compensation to farmers, if researchers only had a little bit of this, it would make a big difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the case. You mentioned a couple things that were, I kind of clued in or keyed in on there, and you said real a few times, that word. And I guess that's what I'm really trying to address is the reality here and then the pros and cons of everything and then what can be done. And there's a lot more that we can do. And so much of it's about just, as you talked about polarization, it's about human behavior. And it's a lot easier sometimes to I don't know why, but it's easier for a lot of people to send $20 or $50 or $100, whatever it is, to an environmental group somewhere, but not really give a second thought to how, where they got their meat or food or whatever it is from, and not want to spend maybe a dollar more on a predator-friendly kind of product. So it's, the things that they can do that really have action and have real consequences, sometimes we sort of ignore, but we're a lot better just sort of assuaging our guilt, kind of buying it away by, sending money to somebody else that in some part, a lot of these groups do great things, but a lot of them have $10 million budgets, $2 million of it they spend on marketing, and that's we don't spend anywhere near that much on wolf management in the lower 48 there in the Rockies. And it's weird that people spend as much on marketing campaigns for animals and spend less on the actual management. That is kind of upside down, isn't it?
Yeah. I think the thing that I enjoyed most about your book is meeting these young graduate students who actually do this research, John.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I, to the point where it really frustrated me that the book was so short that you really couldn't help me get to know these youngsters better. But there's a lot of creativity and imagination. The takeaway for me is a lot of creativity and imagination going into finding ways, mostly through science, but also through technology, to enable this coexistence. And then you say you don't want to forget about the simple things like timing. That there's only a certain time when predators are going to be able to get the calf, and if you can just change the time, if you can change the way that just phenology essentially, There's so much that we don't really know, and it's the exact sort of research that nobody wants to put any money into.
Yeah. Well, there's enough people doing it that I was able to, you know, document some of these different researchers and things. But, so much about it is, you know, it's optimism, it's innovation. I think the best science takes a whole bunch of imagination, and it's not always these big, you know, I'm not looking for the big picture, be-all, end-all kind of grand things. We're just sort of kind of resolving issues one at a time. And the most important thing here relative to predator issues is having a whole bunch of tools in the toolbox and using the right tool for the job. And like I said, timing. Certain things will work maybe for a short time, but as long as you time it when the calves are most vulnerable and before elk, the calves hit the ground, for instance, if you put it at, you know, in that particular instance. Or there's also... Well, some things with black bears getting into corn crops, and there's a really short window that they get into the corn. And since it's a short window, it makes things like translocation effective because they don't come back, which they would in other situations. So it's just about understanding the biology and then being innovative in how you apply solutions.
You end the book up in Churchill, Manitoba, and you end it with the indigenous people up there dealing with large numbers of one of the biggest and nastiest and hungriest predators there is, the polar bear, coming ashore. And, you know, people are, if you don't know a polar bear, you might think of them as warm and fluffy, but they're not. they're real killers. And and you were impressed that somehow the community, including children going to school and everything, has got this figured out, deals with this problem effectively.
Right. And that's what I think. If they can do it with Churchill, I mean, you know, we're not going to institute all the same things that they have everywhere in the U.S. But at the same time, if they can deal with polar bears there, we should be able to deal with coyotes in our backyards and, you know, in New York or wherever it is. And I guess that's the point with ending on that. And also just sort of an ending on an idea of optimism, that if we see there's value to these species, and we put our minds to it, there's ways to coexist with them. I just kind of wanted to make that point.
Yeah, well, I think there are Alaskans listening right now who are acquainted with the McNeil River, and now there's a number of bear sanctuaries that we have here for the brown bear. I don't know. Have you ever experienced one of those?
No, I haven't gone up to McNeil. No, I ought to, though.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it is balancing that. You've got this big attraction, this big value, but everybody that's generally going there are mostly going to be pretty well. I mean, the education's out there. There's a lot of things you can do to keep yourself safe, whether it's fishing or doing whatever.
And, right. Well, and that's what I'm. That's what I'm getting at is that much as they found in Churchill, you know, you the first thing you do is you create an area that's off limits to the bears, and they're not allowed in there, period.
Yeah.
And it's a problem. A bear gets where it's not supposed to be. That's a problem. You're going to have to deal with that.
Right. And that's a great point. One of the crucial elements to acknowledge right up front is that these things are carnivores. These things are predators. These things kill things for a living. And I don't ever want to fairy tale them or broad brush them as being these, you know, nice things that won't hurt people. They will. Is it exceedingly rare for, you know, especially for wolves or whatever? Yeah, or mountain lions to kill people. Yeah, it's extremely rare. You're 400 more times more likely to be struck by lightning than killed by a cougar. But at the same time, will they do it? Yes, they will. And so the message is that we shouldn't be running around afraid of these things and reacting purely out of fear. What we should be doing is respecting them as the animals that they are and going about, you know, behaving in ways that's respectful of that will keep us and our children or whatever safe.
And, of course, you know, in the state of Utah, you get quite a bit of this, and you get it in a number of urban areas with, sprawling subdivisions now, where there's actually an interface with wilder country. And there are then, if you live in someplace like that, you probably love your view. And yet there's things about that view that might really be sending the wrong kind of signals to predators.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's a lot of arguments I get where people say, well, of course that you're causing problems with coyotes because you just put your house, you moved into their habitat. And that's only half true. The other half of it is when we go into places, we actually alter the habitat considerably, especially the west U.S. We irrigate. We plant all sorts of plants that are really desirable to things like deer. And if there are deer there, that's going to attract things like coyotes. People leave pet food out. They leave bird, feed out. They do things.
Yeah, we have that problem right here. We have that problem in Anchorage.
Right there.
Yeah, up on the hillside, it's pure bear habitat. And yet people don't understand. No, you really can't have your bird feeders out there in the summertime.
And that's what I'm hoping, if nothing else, another message of the book here is just to kind of get ourselves to be responsible for what we're doing, too. So a lot of these problems, they always talk about the fed bear is a dead bear kind of thing, and these problems start with people just not thinking. And a lot of times, you don't think leaving garbage out or having pet food outside is anything, dangerous or whatever. But once you get, feed a bear once, boy, they're going to come back and back and back. And same with coyotes. And as they get more habituated to people, they get more dangerous. So it's about kind of taking our own responsibility for how we fit in and coexist with these animals.
Yeah, I'm thinking of wool now and of how Gordon Haber's research showed us that wolves have families. I mean, he liked to call them families instead of packs. And I think you're probably acquainted with Gordon's work to some degree. But his idea was that there was a learning culture within the family. And if that family, it could have more or less of a, it's not an equilibrium exactly, but they know where their range is and they know how to get the food that they need to get. He used the example of a pack that got hugely disrupted through trapping, but they managed to survive because it was a good year for rabbits, which, as you know, in Alaska and I think just about anywhere, you have this cycle between the lynx and the hares, and so they just happened to have abundant prey. Otherwise, they wouldn't have known what to do with a moose calf or anything. They had to go on and learn that. And it seems, I'm wondering if the relationship I'm looking for here is if maybe a mature family of wolves acts quite a bit differently from a bunch of young wolves that haven't quite got it figured out yet in terms of taking risks and in terms of then being more of a problem and less predictable to people that have livestock.
Right. Oh, there are so many things that you brought up in that one. It seems like a simple story there, but there's so many elements of that are really interesting. And one of which is this idea where you do have animals like wolves or coyotes that might be in an area and not killing livestock. I'm just focusing on livestock conflicts here for this argument. And the same with cougars as well. And some of the best research on this has been with cougars, and they have this territory. You'll have a big tom, an old male, and what he does is he maintains this big territory and doesn't let any other males in. And what the research has shown is that if we go and harvest that male, then what happens is three or four other younger males that are kind of looked at as, I've heard them referred to as juvenile delinquents. They come in, they're sort of the teenagers, they're kind of, not as tactful, I guess. And you can quadruple your problem with livestock depredations by removing that one animal and disrupting that social structure. And I think Haber was onto some of that in identifying the social structure of these animals, the territorial structure of these animals. And by knowing something of that, it can help us devise better problem or better management strategies. And sometimes, disrupting that, it makes it worse. There's ways of, if you remove one coyote from a pair and it's got to feed pups, then you can increase the damage to lambs because they've got to work that much harder to feed their pups. instead of, you know, they need the big packets of food instead of just living on rabbits or whatever.
Absolutely. So absolutely fascinating. John Shivick is our guest. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. He's compiled a whole lot of research about coexisting with predators, what we know, what we don't know, what we'd like to know. And there's just so much and so many different things we could talk about. And you're welcome to join the conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. There is no lack of Alaskans with experience with predators. 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. Of course, you know about the Chignik Lake incident where a young teacher, a woman, she was not very tall. She was just out running, and she was taken down by a wolf. There's no indication that it might have been more than one wolf, but there's no indication that there was anything wrong with the animal. This is not a case where some diseased or desperate wolf, you know, it wasn't like that. This is pure predation. Something running and something chased and bringing it down.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible. It's a tragic event. And it's definitely, we really need to figure out a way. We really should have zero tolerance for this kind of event. And knowing more about the animals and about humans and how we're planning the landscape and how we're, you know, where people are jogging or where paths are made and then appropriate things for people to do if they do confront animals. And there's nothing else to say about that other than tragic, and we need to prevent those things from happening.
Well, you were pretty relentless about it early in the book.
Yeah.
You say, look, and people say that predators don't kill people. It's complete bunk. It's totally contrary to the facts.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and it's counterproductive because then people start arguing about whether wolves kill things, and that's just a silly side argument. I mean, it's dumb. You know, they kill things, that's what they do. We shouldn't even be having this discussion. And so much of when wolves were being brought back to the Rockies was about, well, it's overstated that wolves kill things. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, but they will. So don't promise that these things are not dangerous and then look like you're lying if they do. So that's what we need to accept. And you brought that up with family groups too, that we need to accept that these things are predators and they are animals. And what I also like to do, rather than, you know, refer to them as family groups, because it's sort of this idea that we're anthropomorphizing them or otherwise softening them or something like that, and we need to not do that. But I my argument is more as we need to understand how humans fit in and realize that humans are animals and we're predators just like them as well, and we can also be prey just like they can be. So we're at this unique crossroads where we got to figure out how are we going to interact? Are we going to be sometimes predators, sometimes prey? You know, how are we going to function with these animals? And do it in an honest way. And that's really what I'm about here. It's just honesty. How can we really deal with these animals and what they can do and what they can't do? And let's stop trying to scare each other and focus on solutions instead.
Okay, I have to bring up the bear bells. You're not very kind. I mean, we got to, there's a faction in Alaska that would not dream of going into the woods without a gun. I'm just telling you that. And, you know, I'm not in that faction, but I definitely would carry bear spray, although I've never had to use it. In fact, my can of bear spray might even be out of date. I just thought of that. it might be a false sense of security going on there, now that I think about it. But also, these bells, you say, we don't even know if the bears can hear that frequency very well, or they can separate it from the background.
Right, right. And so here's the thing, and this is another thing that's been a real good research paper onto relative to guns. The most important tool, weapon, whatever you can bring with you in the backcountry isn't the bear spray or the gun or the bells. It's your brain. And to be aware and to pay attention and to use these different tools appropriately. You know, the bell thing, maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. It's probably good to make – it's fine. You know, it's definitely good enough to surprise a grizzly bear. So, you know, noise and everything has potential. But if you have a gun or if you have bears or bells or if you have bear spray, are you now Superman and immune from bear attacks? No. And if you lead yourself in a false sense of security that you don't have to worry about anything because you have one of these things, then – that's a problem. So
I think that's that is so true. I mean, I have personally like coexisted with a brown bear, and very close quarters, and we got to know one another. I'm not talking about warm fuzzy got to know one another, but I knew where the bear was likely to be. I knew that I needed to make noise when I went around that place, and this was I'm talking twice a day, you know.
Yeah.
And the bear would make sure that I didn't ever see her.
Yeah,
and that's just
and
the way.
I mean, that's using your brain. That's don't just rely on a gun. That should be your. The research shows that isn't the most important aspect of it, and there's a lot of things that can still go wrong. So it's really about training and using your brain and doing exactly. Don't get into that situation to begin with if you can.
Okay, John Shivick, I got a call from Nancy in Trapper Creek who wants to talk to you about the problem she's got out there. Nancy, you're on Talk of Alaska.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a problem my whole community knows about. It started 3 years ago, and I have a black bear that, with the troopers and the fishing games and blessings, has a I have a game trail that goes right across the back of my property here on top of Hillside. And I've lived out here 28 years, and I've never had a problem with the wildlife. I respect them, and they respect me, and I have a dog in my backyard, and everything stays fine. But I was gone one summer, and she claimed my property as her property. I'm on a hillside, and I have one hillside that's all wild blueberries, all ferns that I understand they eat. And a third hillside that just has a mix of all natural foods and a quarter mile on each side from salmon streams. So this is her perfect habitat. And she charges me if she can be a couple hundred feet away and she sees me, she'll come charging at me. I can be in my yard working and she's nowhere around, but if she hears me and she's down the hill, I can hear her charging me. She's tried to break in my house while I'm standing there in the doorway. She's tried to bust into my car, and this is amazing to me if the people don't know about it. They will hook their claws into the weather strip and look at it until they can pop a window. And she got one paw into the weather strip on my little Subaru wagon and got a hold of the rack on the roof with the other one and used her body like cracked the whip with my car, just thrashing her body, and had my Subaru almost up on two wheels.
Nancy, I don't mean to laugh. This is absolutely amazing what you're telling me, but I mean, that's a DLP situation, isn't it?
Well, they tell me they find some neighbors to get out here and hunt them, and this bear knows when there's a man around. If it's just me, she doesn't mind bothering me. Fishing game came out here one morning way early because she generally showed up at 7 o'clock. And they put snares and everything out and sat here for several hours, and she never showed up. So they figured, well, she's not going to. They left, and 30 minutes later, she was in my yard.
Whoa.
The troopers have been out, and she hides till they're gone, and then she comes out. I think this is a wily bear.
Okay, well, let's John Shivick, how about that problem? You got any ideas for Nancy at Trapper Creek?
Yeah, I was having a very difficult time hearing her, but it sounded like this bear was being relatively bold and aggressive. Was I getting that right?
She is incredibly aggressive to me. She hides from men and wants me.
Yeah. Well, this is okay. There's a few things. One is, again, I talk about the zero tolerance kind of thing. We need to be really careful, and I definitely err on the side of human safety here. And if it, you know, this is one of these situations where this bear, and bears are individual. It's weird that way. There will be one that'll key in on one thing. Bears are uniquely challenging because blackberry, you know, because they have, what, 8 months or so to eat 12 months worth of food. They're really motivated. And if they find a way that they can get food and get it in a regular way, they will come back and be so persistent. So
Nancy, I want to ask you this question. How come you haven't killed this bear?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
I have never killed an animal in my life, but after this, I have a 12-gauge shotgun, and I ain't afraid to kill.
It may come to that. I mean, this is a pretty clear defense of life and property issue. That's why I said DLP. I mean, they're very liberal in Alaska with their interpretation of what constitutes DLP anyway.
So. These behaviors, from what I could hear, I mean, this is inappropriate. I just would hate for you to get hurt or anything or more property damage. I think this isn't something that's going to be simply solved with just a go-away bear or lighter siren or something like that. This is something that kind of, from my interpretation, has got a little over the edge. This bear probably ought to be removed.
I agree. I had three or four gentlemen out here all last summer trying to find her. I had a broken ankle last year. And I went to just go out to feed my dog in the backyard. He's on a 30-foot chain, so he has room to protect himself. And I just opened the door, and she was behind my outhouse, and she swat her cub and pulled up the tree and come charging me. And if I'd been out in my yard in my ankle with my broken ankle in a cast, I would have been bear breakfast.
Nancy, keep that shotgun handy.
It is. It's a part of my body.
All right. Thanks for your call, Nancy, from Trapper Creek.
No suggestions other than killer two.
Keep listening here, and maybe John Shivick can come up with some more answers after the break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Well, we're back with John Shivick, Mammal Program Coordinator at Utah's Division of Wildlife Resources, handling predators and writing about them in his book, The Predator Paradox, Ending the War with Wolves, Bears, Cougars, and Coyotes. And John, welcome to the world of Alaska predator problems. You're probably enjoying this, but it's very serious. I mean, we just had a caller that said she never killed anything in her life. And she's got this situation.
Right. Yeah, let me preface a couple things. I just have to go back to the introduction there. So this book I did based on my research and activities. I didn't do this with relative to the Utah division or anything like that.
You are not speaking for the state, for the great state of Utah. I understand that.
I am not. Yes, exactly. So I should just clarify that. But relative to this, this is another really important point, and people might see this look at the title or whatever and think that all this is, and it is, this is 90% about non-lethal techniques and things, but one thing that came up with your caller there is there, I really look at it as a continuum of different kinds of methods and tools and things you can do, and I don't look at it as lethal versus non-lethal. There are certain times when you need to remove that animal, and that sure sounded like one of them, where if it's human health, safety, or real serious problem, that bear is going to keep on coming back. You can't kind of lily dip. You need to go in there and be responsible for dealing with the problem. So sometimes, yeah, we can. The majority of times we can do non-lethal things, and flags like the flattery we talked about, or lights or sirens or who knows whatever, scare devices and things. But then there are certain times where these things can be dangerous, and we need to deal with the issue that way too. So
yeah.
it's important to accept that.
I'll tell you one thing that's really been revolutionary out at fish camp. We have salmon streams, And we have people that spend all summer running, preserving fish there. And, of course, they're hanging those fish up outside, and there's bears. And that has always been problematical, but electric fences have really made a difference at fish camp.
Yeah, that's the thing, and that's also something that we know about the different predators, is to adapt tools for the right animal. Things like flattery work great for wolves, but bears, they don't care. Bears will just step on it, eat it, chew it, they don't care. But electric, they really pay attention to, and if you can get a somewhat portable electric fence around a beehive or your fish, you know, then especially if you can do something where you can be even a little more clever, and for instance, and just maybe put a little fish oil on one of the wires before you charge it. The first thing that bear's going to do, he's going to smell, he's going to try to investigate, and his first contact with this fence is going to zap right on the tongue or the nose, and it'll really help him learn quickly. Oh, I don't want to go there. That, you know, that hurts, and bears really respond to that. So we can not only use electric fence, but we can use things that we know about animal learning and behavior to even be more effective with these tools and techniques.
Well, that brings up that trap you talk about, which is based on the idea of the, I think it's a wolf, right? Any kind of canine, maybe, that because they like to bite on something and then pull on it, and that was utilized in a non-lethal trap design.
All right, so it's called the collarum, and what it's just a couple little arms. You bury it, and it has a tab that sticks out of the dirt, and when they pull on the tab, it throws a lasso essentially over their head. And then if you have a stop on it, then they're held like a dog on a leash and a collar. It's pretty ingenious. And what's nice about it, we're trying to get more selective all the time about capture techniques, and that's only going to capture a canid, something that puts its mouth down and pulls on it. A bear is generally going to swat at it, and they're bigger, and you know it's not going to get over their head. A ground squirrel even can dig it up or whatever, but he's at most going to get launched a few feet. You know, if he does set it off, he's going to get snapped into it. So here's the thing: is this innovation? And that's where I wanted to document the different students and different approaches. I had people from England coming over and had never even seen a coyote before, and turned out to be one of my best researchers working on some of these issues. And then guys, you know, rural guys from, you know, southern Idaho that are, you know, way more familiar with these things. And getting a diversity of people looking at this to come up with different ideas, that's what's going to lead us to just better, you know, better and better methods of handling conflicts between humans and carnivores.
You have an anecdote here. I think you're speaking of Lynn, right?
Yes.
And she appears several times in the book, and one of them is a really scary episode where she's dealing with coyotes in a pen, and she's in there with them.
Right.
And she barely gets out alive.
Yeah, well, without getting hurt. Yeah, so I wanted to highlight the reality of you know, dealing with these animals and paying attention and realizing, yes, they are carnivores, they are predators. Again, like you said, I'm not sugarcoating or whitewashing that at all. And I thought that was kind of important just up front to get that out there. And that anecdote, that story, she had to go into the pen and she had to gather some, you know, leftover items and test materials and all that kind of thing. And then this is a large area. This is, you know, a few acres, and so she has to go in, and she's 100 yards, 200 yards, or whatever it was, into the thing, and turns around. These coyotes are getting aggressive in between her and the exit, and so she has to use a stick to defend herself and push her way back out. So, yeah, no, it scared the heck out of her. And she loved these things. You know, when she first was with them, she'd never seen a coyote before, and they're gorgeous, and it's winter, and she's thinking, oh, these are wonderful, lovely things, the way a lot of people think of coyotes or wolves or whatever, or bears as these teddy bears. And they can be gorgeous but dangerous at the same time, and that was a real learning lesson.
Joan joins the program from Girdwood. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Joan.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I have a question about the state of Alaska has an active predator control program with the goal of increasing the number of caribou and moose. And I've heard a lot of scientific debate whether it's been effective or not. And because so many other things can affect prey, such as habitat, weather, and those kind of things. So I'm curious if you have any insights into the effectiveness of this program.
Well, of course, you got to remember, John hasn't seen the situation here, but let's see. John, you want to try and respond to Joan's concern that predative control might not really be doing the job?
Right, and I'm familiar with it up there, and you have unique situations, especially if you have multi-predator systems and multi-prey systems, when animals, they can, so if we, you talked about, we talked about hares and lynx cycles and things before, and a lot of times if a game population goes down, then the predator population has to go down too, so it's not only the predators controlling the prey, it's the prey controlling the predators, and scientists are all the time arguing about this. And then when you put on top of that predator control for game management and in the research that's been done in a variety of areas of the country, it comes out sort of at best 50-50 whether or not it works. And that's why it's controversial, because no one's been able to slam dunk show that, this is always the right thing, because it's even more variable in the Western U.S., where really what controls the game populations is largely habitat, and if you have a drought, then you're going to have fewer deer, and if you have, too much snow or too little snow, same thing up there, it's going to really affect the game populations. So the simple answer is, do predators have an effect on the prey populations? Yes, absolutely, and there's all this talk about, if you've heard about things like trophic cascades and how wolves affect where elk go, and that can also affect the plants and how plants grow and then how willows grow and then how beaver, go into streams. So it's this big complicated thing. And because it's this big complicated thing, you can't just say, well, if I just remove all the predators, it's going to be moose or elk or caribou habitat or paradise. And that's what's led to the controversy. And what I can say is it's not a slam dunk if you do predator control, you've got to automatically get good game populations. That's definitely not the case.
Joan?
Great, thank you.
Okay. I think she was trying to toss a softball on that. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. One of the people I've had on repeatedly is Ted Carasotti. Maybe you know his work because he writes a column for one of the outdoor magazines. But he is very eloquent on the subject of the superiority, and we had Steve Ranella on talking about this too, the superiority of the meat that he knows where it comes from, because he went out and got it. He went out and killed something. He killed an elk or whatever it is to bring that meat to him. And it's worth it. It's worth the money that is paid to get the access, to get the licenses, to the equipment and gear that you need, the days and that you put into it. It's worth it. I'm not asking for your opinion on that, but I'm trying to turn it around to this issue of eco-labeling of meat that is raised in a predator-friendly way, and how that probably might be better meat, but it's certainly going to cost more.
Yeah, right, and those are important aspects, and I do hope that people... there's a lot of arguments in cities and a lot of other books and things coming out about, The Last Child in the Woods or Michael Pollan stuff, about food and where we're getting our food from and thinking about it. And there's a certain, even in Alaska, people have forgot where we are relative to nature. And we're more and more paving and forgetting where we came from and even where our food comes from. And I look at that as a tragic situation, too. And for me, I don't want to be preachy about it and say there's definitely one way or another way to do it. But for me, one of my sort of bonding aspects with carnivores and predators is like I am one too. I have those same instincts. And for me, it's important to kind of be in touch with that side. And so I like to, as much as I can, eat game meat and harvest it myself and really know where that comes from. So when I pull I pull a package out of the freezer. I remember the work of, oh gosh, of stock tracking, of hauling and butchering, and that sort of uneasiness as you're shooting an animal and realizing what you're doing. I think that's really important to accept that in our humanity, at least for me. And for other people, you know, they don't need to go that far. Maybe they want to still eat meat, but then they want to do it in a way that is more predator friendly, and they're certified wildlife friendly, which is a label now or certification now that's growing in popularity. And people, if they go to their organic markets or whatever, can ask for and get that going. And right up to people that, you know, maybe some people don't want to eat meat, and that's fine too, and grow all your own vegetables. But even that has cost, and I argue that, you know, we're predators too. We don't need to, all of us don't need to deny that aspect of us, of it. But those that are willing to, they can. But realize that even if you aren't eating meat, you might be now forcing people to divert a river to irrigate a field for soybean crops or something, which also has its impact on the environment as well. So it's about choosing how we can live with the environment the best way for each of us. That's what I'm arguing, that we should give it some more thought.
And everything continues to change. You know, from my perspective of age, I can say that. From my perspective of diversity of geography that I've lived in, I can say that, you know, where I grew up, for instance, is not near what it was when I was a kid. It's, in some ways, it's wilder. In some ways, there's so little economic reason for people to be there that people have kind of moved out, and wildlife has kind of taken over. It all changed. It changed. This is an area that was clear cut at the turn of the century, the century before this one, the century before the other one, and then came back as hardwoods, and those hardwoods then created incredible deer browse, and so then you had this huge population, a huge overpopulation, really, of white-tailed deer, but we didn't know at the time. We just thought it was normal. And then, of course, the nature of the forest changed, and that changed the deer population, and people yearn for the good old days. So nothing stays the same, and everything is porous. So you build these suburbs, and you don't realize the effect your golf course is having, the effect your green belt, a nice green belt along your stream. Everybody wants that, but that's a wildlife corridor, too.
Yeah, and that's what's pretty important. It's a couple of things. One, you know, humans are pretty myopic. We're pretty short-sighted about things, and we also kind of forget. And again, I'm talking about the lower 48 here. There were the deer were almost completely wiped out. And, you know, in the 1920s, there might have been 5,000 deer in Utah, and now there's right about 350,000 or something like that. And it's because of people looking forward and saying, "Oh, we don't want to lose these species. We want to bring these things back." And that movement grew more. And then in the 70s, now you get rid of the toxins on land, and now we've got bald eagles, and we've got all these other great things. And now we need to think as we continue to sprawl, and we grow differently now. You know, we sprawl like we didn't do before. We need to really think about how we're changing and altering the landscape, and how that's going to bring us into contact with some of these different animals. And my hope is that we do that.
Wow. It's almost like we're ending up going back to patch agriculture as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
John Shivick, author of The Predator Paradox, fascinating conversation today on Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Pamela joins the program from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Pamela.
Hi, thank you. A very interesting show today. I really have enjoyed almost all of what your guest has spoken of. The only issue I have is that when you both talked about animal lovers or animal rights activists sending money into the big organizations, and that if they would just think about where their meat comes from, I thought was very condescending, because a lot of us are vegetarian and vegan and don't eat any meat or wear any leather or any animal products. And so I think you need to look at not just what you think of as an animal rights activist or an animal lover, as you put it. So that's my only comment.
Well, no, that's good. And I'll go in and just, you know, apologize right up front. That's not the way the comments were meant. And I really don't want to be condescending or alienating or anything. I really want to acknowledge that, you know, one of the things I learned with a lot of lens studies and research is all these animals are different, and they've got these different personalities, and people are the same way, and some people have more of a predatory drive, and some people have less, and I don't want to tell you how to live your life or whatever, or I don't want to label people or otherwise offend them that way. I think it was more about a general notion. I think what I was trying to get across was a general notion that let's think of how we're living with the environment versus, you know, thinking that, you know, just by throwing money somewhere, it's going to resolve all these issues and we're going to feel better. So I'm kind of asking people to do the hard work, too, and to think about it a little bit more deeply than just writing checks, if that makes sense.
Right, right, which it does, and I think a lot of us have looked at it more deeply, which is why so many of us don't wear or, you know, use animal products, and, you know, don't, you know, like there's a woman in Sitka who, unfortunately, a bear ate her dog, and now she wants to go kill bears, and, you know, she's not looking at the big picture that it was a bear that was hungry. So that was my only comment, is that there's so very many of us that who do look at the big picture.
Yeah,
so, but thank you. I look forward to reading your book.
Good. Yeah, I wish there were more. So, no, I appreciate what you're doing.
Pamela,
all right, thanks.
Thank you so much. Bye. Very glad you brought that up. Calling from Sitka. Our guest is John Shivick, and joining us from Palmer is Bruce. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bruce.
Hey, John, Steve. It sounds like a great book. I look forward to reading it. The question or the point I wanted to bring up is this. Just like what the lady before was talking about, is people's innate fear of predators. And I think much of that is based on just their lack of understanding. A few years ago, Steve, there was a woman that was jogging down on the Alaska Peninsula with her headset on, and she was attacked by wolves and killed and eaten.
Right, we talked about that, yes.
Yeah, people freaked out about that, but what was she looking like? I mean, she was an uninformed prey item to a wolf and fleeing from them. And I would have expected that kind of behavior from the wolves, and she should have been aware of what she was doing. She was running in the wilderness acting like prey. And a lot of the way we act around predators or how we treat predators or do predator control, I think, is based on this lack of understanding and the innate fear that we have of these animals.
I think you touched on a few important points. One thing I do want to, I mean, there's no way around it. That was tragic. That was terrible. And I think we need to be sensitive to that. But we also, and the point that you do make that is important is we need to put things into context, and we need to realize what our motivator is. And if you read through this book, you'll read, it's one theme that comes out repeatedly is fear. And mostly what we're reacting out of, and the reason we're being irrational about how we're reacting and how we're responding to these things, is because we're overly fearful and we're shooting from the hip and we're overreacting. And I think that point you made, and the previous caller made that too, we need to put things in the right context and realize what we can do and keep the pendulum from swinging all the way to, if one bad thing happens, that we need to kill everything out there. We need to be rational. That's why I'm really trying to argue. I'm trying to assuage the fears and have people be a little more comfortable and knowledgeable and prevent these things from happening, but do it in a way that it's not, you know, but that it's coming from a good place.
Right, right. When I've been surrounded by a pack of 20 wolves in the and this is the middle of the night with my 6-year-old daughter, we didn't have a firearm. And the juveniles came down and confronted us, and we just had a Coleman lantern. And they could have easily have taken us, but there's this communication between the juveniles and the adults. And I think the communication was, we don't eat people, and that's kind of the normal behavior. So we just stood out there in the dark and enjoyed that experience. And I mean, that's the normal standard behavior, and you stand your ground, and there's nothing to fear. You just have to learn how these animals operate. They're, we're not standard prey for them.
Right. But that's you're very lucky to have that. I mean, most people in most of the U.S., this is what I'm arguing. It's also sad and tragic that people don't get to have those kinds of experiences. And I dedicate the book to my son because I want him to grow up and to be able to see predators and things. I want him to be in that situation where there is that hint of danger. I mean, that's life. That's reality. I don't want him to only see these things on nature shows or in a zoo someplace where there's a protective cage between him and the animal. I think that connection with nature is really important for humans. And I think we can do that. I think we can be wise and know the animals we're dealing with and do it safely.
Yeah, well, so when your son gets a little bit older, send him up and I'll take him out. We'll hang out with some predators.
That's great. I might take you up on that.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for that call there, Bruce, in Palmer.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, John.
I want to clarify one thing. I think I misinterpreted, John, what you were saying about the environmental groups and animal rights groups. You were saying if the money that they just spend to raise more money was instead put into wildlife research, that'd make you much happier.
I just brought out the notion. It was not as much of that aspect of it, more of the notion of it just strikes me as weird that we spend more money advertising to get money to, for Save the Wolf campaigns than we actually spend on wolf management and resolving the conflicts that they cause. So this book is about the reality that, these animals are out there in the environment. I would like to have them on the out there, but there's a cost associated with it. And are we going to use that cost to create more fears? Whether, a lot of organizations are, they're blanketing the lower U.S. saying wolves are about to go extinct, and that's what people think. And they're using that to get more money. And my argument is, shouldn't we be spending at least as much on actual management and resolving these problems and research about ways to resolve conflict? So I don't want to really point fingers or, be a pest.
Yeah.
But I do hope that we will, move forward and not keep on drumming up this fear notion.
We're out of time.
Okay.
Thanks, John Chivik, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Talk of Alaska thanks to Joaquin Palomino, Sean Carpenter, Pat Yack, Josh Edge, Monica Gogi. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack and stroke, miscarriage and other diseases. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.